This is Product by Design, a podcast by Prodigy, where we explore technology, artificial intelligence, user experience, product management, and the philosophy of building products and companies. All right, welcome back to another episode of Product by Design. I am Kyle, and this week we have another awesome guest with us, Pete Hawks. Pete, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Kyle.
Awesome. Yeah, well, great to have you here. Let me give a brief introduction for Pete, and then Pete, you can tell us a little bit more about yourself. But Pete is a designer and developer, a tinkerer and mentor with a passion for human-centered design and development. He's an educator and the head of design at Daily, which is a developer-first WebRTC API platform. So a lot to unpack there, and I'm excited to talk more about it. But why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, sure. I'm a designer by training. I went to have a degree in graphic design. It was a traditional degree, primarily focused in things like typography, branding, editorial design, book binding, letterpress, and the like, which I thoroughly loved. But I've always been close as well. Pre-internet, I was tinkering around on bulletin board and other things, and always into games, and that led to an affinity for programming as well. And so I've mixed the two throughout my career. Early career, I was a Flash guy, so built a lot of one-off Flash experiences for better, and really thoroughly enjoyed that part of my career. Around 2009, and I went back to grad school at UCLA in their design media arts program. And since then, I've been working primarily with tech startups, where I've really enjoyed working closely with very talented engineers.
That's a great background, and I'm excited to dive into it a little bit more. But before we do, why don't you tell us a little bit more about, you know, maybe what you like to do outside of design and outside of the office?
Oh, sure. I have three children. They keep me very busy. So outside of the office, spending a lot of time with them, but also time outdoors. That's where I think most clearly and where I get the most inspiration. I live in the Bay Area in Northern California. So there's just so much to explore and see, from coastal areas to the mountains. And I should spend even more time than I do, but that's where I'm happiest.
Very nice. All right. Well, I'm excited to kind of talk a little bit more about design, about some of your background, some of your experience, and maybe you can tell us a little bit more about some of your journey. You know, you talked about starting early in design, in graphic design, you know, some of the early web and Flash. You know, tell us a little bit more about that journey, and then eventually what brought you to your current role and what you're doing now.
Yeah, I mean, I spent a lot of time with Flash, and as I said, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I think what I liked about it was the balance between design, this kind of, and technology. The Flash was a very, very tech application. I'm with it, but it also had nice affordances, like this is like a time and other things that made motion design and interaction quite a bit more straightforward. I loved Flash as a platform because I mentioned mentorship in my bio. It was a great tool for teaching designers and artists, like an entry point for more technical things. The interface was familiar and it was friendly, and I think it guided creatives into more technical workflows in a really gratifying way. And I love that. I taught Flash at the university level for that reason. Very much enjoyed it. I ran an Adobe user group for Flash as well for a while for that same reason. And since, have even in my post flash life. I've gravitated to similar tools like processing and Arduino that are very technical and very capable technically as well, but are geared and really designed in a way that they don't alienate creatives. And so my career has really been kind of tracking that intersection, been design and technology. Grad program I went through at UCLA was fantastic for that. It's called Design Media Arts. And it's kind of one part graphic, as we might think of it more generally. Another part with a capital A, and then another part is pure technology, experimentation, tinkering. I spent some time at a research lab with Nokia. After that, it was a short stint, but there I. And in that grad program, I got used to hanging out with and collaborating with engineers. And I love working with other designers as well. But it was almost like I found a lot more creative opportunity when paired with really capable engineers. And also, as it is with these things, a lot more commonality than is typically expected. Engineers solve really tough problems and they do it creatively. And there was a lot of opportunity to kind of understand better the engineering side of things, but also advocate for the creative side of things. I find them a better designer if I can speak technical language and understand those processes. And so I've invested time in technical chops, at least sharp enough that I can empathy for the engineers that I'm working with. And after grad school, I worked at a type of a startup where we explored all sorts of different types of experiences, product design, and cutting edge technology of all sorts. I worked for a startup called Oblong Industries. They're based in Los Angeles, famous mostly from one of the co-founders worked on Minority Report. And a lot of what we ended up doing were large-scale data visualization spaces, but also simulations and extreme multi-user interfaces and future forms of computing. It was a lot of fun. Also a business that the pandemic early and ended. Because a lot of our biggest projects did in physical spaces, which quickly became vacant, executive briefing centers and large collaboration spaces. Fortunately, years prior, one of the co-founders had spun off of that company, had started a new venture using many of the had solved a lot of really hard problems and worked in this space around collaboration, video collaboration across the world at a really high fidelity, and started a company called Daily, where I work now. And initially, Daily was working also in a similar collaboration space with kind of hardware in the mix, but starting around 2014, my dates are probably completely off here because I wasn't part of this history. But I think core to it is the founders realized that video is essentially going to be anywhere, and if anything that we do online on a device has some sort of video component. And so Daily really was starting to build tools for video. And with COVID, those opportunities kind of exploded because Mysteries pivoted very rapidly into virtual video spaces. So today, daily, if you're adding a video communication to your app or to your website, we help you do that. It's similar to any other third-party implementation. Like if you needed something to handle payments, you might use Stripe. If you need video in your product, use Daily. And it's built on WebRTC, which is like a global standard. What we do now is we supply, simple tools for getting started in that space if you're not really sure where to start. And we partner with interesting companies that allow non-technical folks to get a footing. Video is hard. and that's our goal, is to make hard things easy. So we have great documentation, great tutorials, great support. And along the way, there are plenty of interesting design problems that arise either from maintaining all of those materials and infrastructure and just generally the brand that goes along with it, but also in interfacing with our customers and helping them solve their own product problems.
I think that's really interesting because, like you said, I think video is becoming so much more prevalent, and it's, obviously I think we've all seen that through not just the recent past, but just through social media, through all of the applications and things that we're using. So I'm interested, what are some of the things that you're seeing, video becoming more and more a part of through the work that you're doing? Like, what are some of the most common applications? And then maybe what are some of the more interesting applications that you've seen video being integrated into?
I'll speak first to where I started in the collaboration space. During the pandemic, I ran a product design and engineering team in the later years of Oblong. We were building out a web-based, browser-based collaboration tool focusing primarily on sharing multiple items simultaneously and some new UX flows related to what that might look like. Exploring use cases where that would be particularly useful, not just me presenting to you, but the two of us sharing our pixels at the same time and working collaboratively together live. But doing that, and this was something that we worked on in a much larger and more complex scale at Oblong, but we wanted to build a tool that would do that in a browser. Mostly so that it would address the current need, which was that everybody was working from home and these new needs arose. This is incidentally way into Daily is we implemented Daily platform into that product. So before I joined, I was a customer. But the collaboration space is, and there's ed tech is huge in that space. Future of work, we have customers exploring virtual office spaces in lieu of the physical spaces. Telehealth is massive for us. We have some, there's a lot of traction here, as you might imagine, not just in like therapy sessions, but today when you say, oh, I'm gonna like, I have a doctor's appointment and it's gonna be by video, it's kind of a given. It's safer for a number of reasons. There's some great accessibility that comes along for the ride, but it was less common not too long ago. You say, what now? Right. Compliance is a big part of that. So that was actually one of the big pushes on our platform early on, was to be HIPAA compliant first, which eases the concerns of both customers and doctors for liability reasons. So telehealth, that's a massive space. Some of the growth areas are maybe more like entertainment driven. We have customers that are finding new ways. Media consumption has been completely upended in the last decade alone. So we have a customer where personalities can do sports watching themselves. So imagine that you and I decide we want to be announcers for X NFL NBA game. and invite-ins, or basically as creators, your space is kind of where it is. So we're a unique experience for watching a particular it could, you know, it could be funny, it could be serious, it could be analytical, it doesn't really matter. But the point is that creators make their own experience instead. And that trickles into the influencer space as well, and how influencers, so custom interfaces that allow influencers to engage with their audiences, whether that's in a broadcast format or in like bringing people up to stage as guests, kind of, so virtual events tie into the same space. And there's a huge increase as well in live commerce, which is massive in Asia in particular, and gaining traction here. My teenage son, for example, he loves using an app where he buys used clothing. And it's different from eBay because there's more of a direct interaction with the seller. It's not live video, but we do have customers that do that as well. The idea is you have, you know, look at these clothes, ask me questions live, or let me demonstrate this product, or I'm doing a cooking show. And while I'm doing a cooking show, there's a button appears on the screen to automatically buy all those ingredients through vendor Y or Z, or purchase this, just this mixer. The engagement, whether it be financial or otherwise, there's a lot of really unique opportunity all through this new, far more common medium of video community. The expectation is high. My kids call me on FaceTime as a default. Right? It doesn't matter. They don't need to see. Sometimes the camera's just staring at the ceiling, but it's there as needed, and it's an expectation. So as they enter the workforce, as you know, as they become professionals themselves, those expectations will trickle up. The same way we saw, you know, things like Twitter that was initially just thought of as a, you know, entertainment communication tool to like core PR communication platform. So
I think that's really fascinating, as especially that last point where it's almost the flip of where the millennial generation avoids the phone call at almost all costs, we don't want to have that verbal communication whenever right. possible. We're seeing it become ubiquitous again in the younger generations, where it's like this idea of a video call or communication is just almost a default means of communication. And like you were saying with your teenage kid, you know, doing a video call as a default, like that's where, you know, my younger kids too are having that kind of default communication, where like video calls are like the default way of communicating. And seeing this just becoming again such a common way of communicating, not just consuming information or media, but of communicating in general. Like it's not just talking or calling, but it's having like the video call and this live interaction with video that is just becoming more and more common. And being able to have that type of interaction embedded into the experiences. And I was actually, that you just brought to mind this idea again, because, you know, this goes to more of a personal experience, but like my kids, they play Roblox and they do it with a video call going on in a separate application. So they can do this with a friend, have a video call and play Roblox at the same time. And Roblox is now introducing the ability to do that in apps. So like be able to have avatars and do video call while playing all at the same time, coming out to my understanding soon. But again, this like having all of these experiences integrated so that you have this video capability within the different apps and within the different experiences, as opposed to having to have multiple types of things going on in different places.
Yes, and gaming is another really exciting space that we work with. We have a number of vendors that are using proximity chat, Some are more Roblox, Minecraft-like experiences. You can walk around, but you can only hear the rest of the people in the game if you are up close to them. You can close a door and and it's private. We did a virtual event recently with a customer of ours called Nowhere, where they host events, and it was really quite interesting. Wandering around the space, we held an all hands in their space. And it really was a similar experience to walking through, you know, a social gathering of some sort, and hearing conversation come and go, and being able to walk off into the corner to have a private conversation with someone, or engage in the main presentation, which was happening in a more central area. It's fascinating, even if the interfaces are fairly crude. How I don't mean that derogatorily, but how much of a like human experience you can derive from those things. My two older children lived in another state for most of their years growing up, and a core part of parenting strategy living in another state was playing Minecraft with them, and Roblox for that matter. Often with a video call, like you do, or like your kids do, open in the background, and I was really with the affordances that these interface created as a parent. You know, I'd go fishing with, so we're not even like mining for ore, or going after the ender dragon. We're just sitting, body of water, fishing, and talking. Yep. And that's, you know, that's it's really great that these types of experiences can you know, can afford such a simple and meaningful experience.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, and it's fascinating in a number of different ways. And I'm interested in, you know, what are some of the UX considerations that you see and that you deal with in all of this? Because it feels like there are so many different ways to approach these problems. You know, you're talking about all of the different industries that you're working with that are beginning to incorporate or have incorporated, you know, these types of things. As you're working through this, you know, what are some of the things that you're thinking about from a UX perspective in order to make a lot of this work in ways that make it feel very seamless and very easy for people using it?
I mean, with all new technologies, there's a lot of stumbling first. You know, hyped up flashes example. You know, the flash intro was ubiquitous across the internet, and is, from a UX perspective, just at like the ridiculousness of having to sit 20-30 second animation commercial of some sort. It seems just utterly ridiculous from a UX standpoint. And yet it was canon. It was a standard. Every site had it. It served a functional purpose. It allowed the larger content to stream in the background. And I think that was part of the reason that it stuck around for so long. But ultimately, from a UX standpoint, it was just, it was wrong. You know, when you walk into a storefront, walk into a shoe store, you know, if you had to sit through a 20-second like dog and pony pitch by a salesperson before you could even enter the store, people wouldn't go into stores. They'd avoid it. They'd go to a different one. And these are the same types of analogies, I think, that work really well when we talk about video UX. You know, Zoom meetings, this is for most folks, it's their first experience in video UX. Zoom, part of the reason they did so well is they took a fairly simple concept that was failing miserable in WebEx. You know, the founders of Zoom came from WebEx, took all of the really frustrating UX pieces and just got rid of them, and built their own tool from the ground up and built it more cleanly. And this is a common success in tech, just to do something more simply. However, there were a lot of things they didn't really get right. If you think being in a conference room and you're scheduled same way you are, right? But as you approach this meeting space, you may see the office on the conference room the outside of the conference room. It might have windows, it might not. Some of those, the door might be open or it might not be. And even that, door is open, a door is closed. If door is closed, I'm probably going to wait or at least check to see if another meeting is in progress before I enter. If it's open, I can look inside and see if I'm the first person there or if there are already a bunch of people there waiting. Am I suddenly late, maybe? My timing was off. You can figure that out if there's a presentation in progress and a bunch of people waiting. In a virtual space, in a Zoom environment, we don't get that. You just drop immediately into a meeting, kind of unawares. Now, increasingly, like the podcast platform that we're using here, there's the hair check. So pre-call experience where I test my microphone, I look at my camera, make sure that in the background, I don't have, you know, unexpected cat or something like that. You know, that pre-call experience is an importance forward in video feedbacks. But there's still so many other things that could be addressed. I mean, the fact that we're connecting to private spaces here, so in my basement, and you're in your home there, and the internet is full of comical video clips of, you know, people, you know, some are hilarious, some are embarrassing, some are just really, really unfortunate. It's because we're fumbling in this space, and there are ways that we can, but all very much addressable as well. And now we have ways to obscure our backgrounds. Hardware is getting better. There are new tools and other integrations. AI makes video processing live and in real time, and in ways that that we couldn't just, you know, just a few months prior. There's also, I think, one interesting aspect to video is authenticity and accountability in some ways. You know, in games like Roblox and Minecraft, you can get a lot of like really bad behavior. This comes from the head of design in the space specifically to address issues of just accountability, behave better when their face is visible rather than being hidden behind an anonymous avatar. So, you know, video, it provides many affordances clearly, but there are also a lot of new considerations, we'll put it that way.
Yeah. I'm interested, kind of going along those same lines, you know, where do you see this going into the future? Now, you mentioned a couple things as far as, you know, things we can address and things that are changing. You know, where do you see this progressing as we go down this road, you know, over the next year or 5 years or even down into the future? You know, what does the future of this look like?
It's all moving really, really fast, but I think increased use of video in products and services where they might not be present or prominent today. You know, in the telehealth space, this may sound bizarre, but imagine that you could actually have a visit to the dentist from your home. Companies are already working on, you know, a simple device that you can purchase, plug into the bottom of your phone, and it will run a level of diagnostics, including everything from like photogrammetry, scanning inside of your mouth, but also talking live with the doctor. You can still have that back and forth action. You can talk about all of your fears, worries, and concerns, and everything else. Doctor can respond in real time while looking at you, and without having to trust town. These are conveniences, but also think of the massive change that has on folks on are unable to travel to receive care. We're talking rural areas, third world economies, or just folks, you know, that for whatever reason can't travel. So that's one like really exciting. And but also other, like right now, service, you know, you're talking with your bank or something like that. If video calls like a standard thing, I could see in the support sphere, there being more affordances on that front. There's a trust thing there as well. Am I talking to a bot? Am I talking to a real person? So you could see companies kind of doubling down on, hey, we have real live support staff. And you can see that it's a real person. They're not tucked in some dark cubicle somewhere in abhorrent conditions, but they're calling me from a real office space or from the comfort of their own home. And they're friendly. And we often discount the huge amount of communication that comes from just body language and posturing, you know. And that can be really critical in health settings and support settings, and a number, and even educational setting. You know, the all plays an important role, and new tools I think will help those experiences be a lot more impactful. So,
yeah, absolutely. I think that makes a lot of sense. Now, I'm interested in, you know, speaking a little bit more about some of the design side. You know, you mentioned teaching and mentoring in design. What are some of the key principles and concepts that you teach and mentor either young designers or people who are, you know, early in their career, growing in their career as designers?
I think the most important theme is kind of breaking down these notions that there's like your creative side and your technical side. In my like K through 12 education growing up, it was very clear. It was basically like you were an artist, and that's what I was branded. I was an artist, and therefore I was not expected to be good at math or science or other things. And I think it's really common, particularly with designers and artists as well. It's proving, sure, and there are plenty of amazing like hybrid examples there, but I think it takes work as an educator. You have to, there are built-in fears that take time to break down. So you know, you talk about code to a designer and they may be terrified, but I've found that scripting languages and other things to be most gratifying creative tools that allow me to iterate through ideas and do things far more quickly and far more capably than if I were using traditional tools. And if you look at it, what is the traditional tool? Like now it's, you know, Figma, but you know, whether it was like Photoshop, Illustrator, Sketch, or any of these others, these are digital tools that have been created by someone else. And ultimately the tools that we use have a very, very strong effect on the design outputs, on the interfaces, on the experiences themselves. So the ability, if you get a taste of that technical side, the ability to craft your own tools becomes, I think, of significant importance. So most of my teaching background has been that. So helping creatively minded folks find ways to explore tool building on their own. And this ultimately is where I've where I work in my career as well. So the last 12 odd years have been in spaces where we build tools for people to realize creative ambitions, their experiential ends and the like. And it works the other way as well. So independent of formal teaching at the level, as I've worked with engineers, I've also tried to put together opportunities for engineers to explore their creative sides. So drawing workshops, like, hey, let's talk about drawing. And they have the same types of fears, right? They'll, I can't draw. Like, I've only ever worked on a computer. But I mean, the act of making a mark on an object, like on a piece of paper, on a surface, is so fundamentally human, right? And so incredibly important. And it ultimately is communication, whether you're writing a word or whether you're creating a pattern or a design or an interface. I think it's really, really important for, regardless of what field you've chosen to like connect with that side. And there are some great tools as well. I use some great patterns from, there's a group in the Netherlands that created this conditional design manifesto. And there are these great tabletop exercises you can do with markers and pencils and paper that are procedurally oriented. So it's so truly it's something Jeneer really resonates with, because as it functions the same way a computer program, but practically speaking, it plays at human speed, at human, and collaboratively with others. And each person contributes their own little bits, and the human element of that ends up creating really, I think, beautiful emergent creations. So I love those types of exercises that kind of blend the two and help help an engineer see the creative side of those things, or a creative see the technical side as well.
I think those are great. And I love what you mentioned about, you know, one, not being limited by the tools, because I think so often, like, either the training or the tools that we get, even if we don't understand it, like, that can limit our thinking. And so breaking outside of that can just open up a whole new horizon of ways of thinking about problem solving. You know, if we're not limited to solving a problem in Figma, for example, or solving a problem with the set of tools that we have, even solving it with code, if it's, you know, we can solve this in any way that we can think of, whether that's drawing it out or solving it in a design tool, or creating our own tool in order to solve a problem. Like, these are all options, and they don't have to be, we don't have to think in any one specific way. It's, you know, we can be creative outside of where we've been formally trained or where we're experienced in, is, I think, so critical to many of us, because it's easy to get really comfortable in the area that we are very familiar with, as opposed to really kind of breaking out of that and being willing to either get technical or get creative, or, you know, get outside of that area that we're very familiar with, like we were saying.
Well, and this is important to careers these days as well. I mean, when I was taking the tests that they give you in high school that tell you what career you're supposed to pursue, for one, the answers I got were bizarre and didn't make any sense to me. It's like cartoonist and commercial artist, and I didn't know what those are. The reality is, my career, as it has been, did not exist when I was in high school. So, and that is the new normal, is that, you know, instead of going and working for IBM or Ford for 40 years and retiring, it's more and more common to reinvent. And I've talked to a lot of designers that have kind of come and gone from traditional design, and similarly to engineers that have kind of moved in and out of different types of roles. So it's really healthy, I think, to keep an open mind and to explore many different aspects of the creative process. So.
Yeah, absolutely. What advice would you give to somebody who is getting into design right now, who's looking to get into it?
Feed that well. Like, you've got to just collecting, I think, is a great tool for design, whether that be nice coffee table books that can get expensive. But there's so much out there to get exposed to, and doing it on your own will be limiting. So you can be very capable. You can go to all the right resources. The best way to get the broadest exposure to modern trends in design, or the history that is just as important to understand, is to do it with friends. So communities are absolutely essential. There are great online communities. And I always counsel students when they're like, yeah, but I don't know which one to join, or where I'm currently at, I don't have access to the ones that I would like to be a part of. I say, start your own. So if you're not finding what you need, the community that you start may be, you know, it may be needed or required. I did that early on in undergrad. No one, either they didn't know Flash or they didn't like Flash. I started a Flash club in my undergrad program, and met some incredibly inspiring and creative people through that, many of whom went on really incredible things, their own agencies, built incredible experiences and campaign to do it. There are great conferences online meetups. All of this has kind of been upended by, you know, recent world events. Coming back online now, a favorite of mine is based in Minneapolis. It's called the IO Festival. These guys post all of their content online, hundreds of hours of incredibly inspiring talks and other things out there to consume. I guess part of it is to not to be overwhelmed by the wealth of information that is out there, but it's also a really exciting opportunity. You don't have to be at, you know, RISD or Art Center to get exposure to these great ideas. You can just access them with the click of a button. So yeah, I think keeping that well full, keeping an open mind, exploring, and doing it with friends. Definitely do it with friends. So in whatever format is comfortable, it could be a small group of people, meet regularly, add a social aspect to it. Flash Club always had snacks. These are really important aspects to keeping a happy kid. You gotta have a reason to come together. You're like, oh, would it take slam and organization? It's like, yeah, but with anythwhile, what you do to it, whatever you invest into it, time or otherwise, will come back many, many fold. I firmly believe in that principle. So
I think that's absolutely great. Well, Pete, this has been a really, really fun conversation with a lot of great insights. And I have a couple of wrap-up questions that we like to do for everybody. And these don't necessarily have to be design or business related, but they certainly can be. Have you read or watched or listened to anything recently that you found interesting and would like to share?
I think one of the best books I read recently was John Cleese's autobiography, So Anyway, it's called. I love biographies, or autobiographies, as is the case with this. I listen to, I'm a painfully slow reader, so I listen to these on Audible while I'm doing yard work or dishes or going on a walk, hiking. And it's a good way for me to move through a lot of material. But John Cleese reads his own book. I have always been of the actor and the content that he's created. So hearing about his own journey, his own insecurities, and everything else that kind of humanizes is, you know, an individual that you make on a pedestal. Strongly recommend that. Related, I also I just Oppenheimer. I found it absolutely beautiful as a standalone artwork. Loved it. It did not feel like 3.5 hours to me, and that's typically a good sign that I was properly immersed and engaged in the content. Related, I loved the book about Frank Oppenheimer. Another biography that I read probably about 12 years back. It's called Something Incredibly Wonderful Happens. Fascinating life. And Frank, after just a quick teaser for this particular book, he was a little bit more ousted from scientific circles because of his involvement with communism, and ended up teaching physics in rural Colorado to like farm kids. And as a result, came up with really practical demonstrations of really complex ideas, which eventually led to founding the Exploratorium in San Francisco, which is an incredible science museum geared towards children, but fascinating for adults as well, and full of dozens of amazing on experiences that just crack your head wide in ways that no science lecture ever could. So biographies.
I'm a big fan of biographies as well, and those are some good recommendations. All right. And last question, are there any products that you've used, either digital or physical, that you've either enjoyed using or, you know, maybe not enjoyed using?
This topic, this is the curse of working in UX design of any kind. You know, as soon as you learn about typography, it's like, whoa, typography. But then suddenly you see how ugly the world can be in some ways, and to learn to live with that. And with me, it's the same with, I have anger management issues when it comes to digital interfaces, because I have high expectations for how things should be. But rather than get into that and the various things, my favorite tool is here with me most of the time, just right here. Favorite tool. This is a Victorinox Swiss Army knife. The brand is strong for a reason. Simple, beautiful. Design hasn't changed in decades. One of my most used tools. Wish the TSA would let me take it everywhere. But I love it. I use it near daily. And I think it's the collation of design and technology and utility, like function and form, right here. It's also a nice toy during meetings.
Could not agree more. I have one on both sets of keychains that I have. And so does my wife. And yeah, we absolutely love them. They're just like you said, simple, super functional. And it's just it's a perfect little tool.
Would that all of our tools could be that simple.
Yes.
But they are not. Yeah. No firmware update required.
Yeah. It just, it works. It has what you need. And
exactly.
Yeah.
There is no substitution for a good tool.
Yep. All right. Well, Pete, this has been a great conversation. Where can people go to find out more about you, about the things that you're working on, anything else?
Well, daily.co is the website of the company that I work for. Incredibly talented engineers, fantastic stuff coming out of this company. I'm excited to see where it goes. I have a personal website that I don't maintain that frequently, but it's at petehawks.com. If you want a wild ride, there's an original website that I absolutely love. That was created probably circa 1998, 1999, still online. And that's peterhawks.com. I go by Pete because peterhawks.com was taken. If you browse there, just click cancel on the first prompt that you see for the original beautiful experience that is peterhawks.com.
Okay. We'll put the links to those in the show notes so you can check those out.
All right.
Awesome. Well, Pete, thanks again. This has been, like I said, a great conversation. Appreciate all of the insight that you've shared.
Oh, thank you, Kyle. I've enjoyed it.
All right. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Thanks again for listening. If you like the show, be sure to follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast app. You can follow the show on TikTok at prodigy.co and on Twitter at prodigyco. You can also follow me on both of those platforms at Kyle Larry Evans. If you want more product conversation, check out my newsletter Prodigy at prodigy.co. You can also follow me on Medium at Kyle Larry Evans, or check out my Medium publication Prodigy. Of course, you can check out all these links in the show notes.